Chapter 27. At precisely 8 o'clock, John Vogel was ushered into Sandecker's office on the top floor of the 10-story solar glass building that housed the national headquarters of NUMA. His eyes were bloodshot, and he made no effort to conceal a yawn. Sandecker came out from behind his desk and shook Vogel's hand. The short, banty admiral had to lean backward and look up to meet the eyes of his visitor. Vogel was 6'5", a kindly-faced man with puffs of unbrushed white hair edging a bald head. He gazed through brown Santa Claus eyes and flashed a warm smile. His coat was neatly pressed, but his pants were rumpled and stained with a myriad of blotches below the knees. He smelled like a wino. "Well," Sandecker greeted him, "it's a pleasure to meet you." "The pleasure is mine, Admiral." Vogel set a black trumpet case on the carpet. "I'm sorry I appear so slovenly." "I was going to say," Sandecker answered, "it seems you've had a difficult night." "When one loves one's work, time and inconvenience have little meaning."
"True," sitting on the couch. "And my special projects director, Dirk Pitt."
Vogel nodded at the swarthy face that crinkled into a smile.
"Mr. Pitt."
Pitt rose and nodded back.
"Mr. Vogel."
Vogel sat down and pulled out a battered old pipe.
"Mind if I smoke?"
"Not at all." Sandecker lifted one of his Churchill cigars out of a humidor and held it up.
"I'll join you."
Vogel puffed the bowl into life and then sat back and said, "Tell me, Admiral, was the cornet discovered on the bottom of the North Atlantic?"
"Yes, just south of the Grand Banks off Newfoundland."
He stared at Vogel speculatively.
"How did you guess that?"
"Elementary deduction."
"What can you tell us about it?"
"A considerable amount, actually. To begin with, it is a high-quality instrument, crafted for a professional musician."
"Then it's not likely it was owned by an amateur player," Gunn said, remembering Giordino's words on the Sappho 1.
"No," Vogel said flatly. "Not likely."
"Could you determine the time and place of manufacture?" Pitt asked.
"The approximate month was either October or November. The exact year was 1911, and it was manufactured by a very reputable and very fine old British firm by the name of Boosey Hawkes."
There was respect written in Sandecker's eyes. "You've done a remarkable job, Mr. Vogel. Quite frankly, we doubted whether we would ever know the country of origin, much less the actual manufacturer."
"No investigative brilliance on my part, I assure you," Vogel said. "You see, the cornet was a presentation model."
"A presentation model?"
"Yes. Any metal product that takes a high degree of craftsmanship to construct and is highly prized as a possession is often engraved to commemorate an unusual event or outstanding service."
"A common practice among gunmakers," Pitt commented.
"And also creators of fine musical instruments. In this instance, it was presented to an employee by his company in recognition of his service. The presentation date, the manufacturer, the employee, and his company are all beautifully engraved on the cornet's bell."
"You can actually tell who owned it?" Gunn asked. "The engraving is readable?"
"Oh, my, yes." Vogel bent down and opened the case. "Here, you can read it for yourself."
He set the cornet on Sandecker's desk. The three men stared at it silently for a long time, a gleaming instrument whose golden surface reflected the morning sun that was streaming in the window. The cornet looked brand new. Every inch was buffed to a high shine, and the intricate engraving of sea waves that curled around the tube and bell were as clear as the day they were etched. Sandecker gazed over the cornet at Vogel, his brows lifted in doubt. "Mr. Vogel, I think you fail to see the seriousness of the situation. I don't care for jokes."
"I admit," Vogel snapped back, "that I fail to see the seriousness of the situation. What I do see is a moment of tremendous excitement. And believe me, Admiral, this is no joke. I have spent the best part of the last 24 hours restoring your discovery."
He threw a bulky folder on the desk.
"Here is my report, complete with photographs and my step-by-step observations during the restoration procedure.
There are also envelopes containing the different types of residue and mud that I removed, and also the parts that I replaced. I overlooked nothing.
I apologize, Sandecker said. Yet it seems inconceivable that the instrument we sent you yesterday and the instrument on the desk are one and the same.
Sandecker paused and exchanged glances with Pitt. You see, we thought the cornet had rested on the sea bottom for a long time. Vogel finished the sentence. I'm fully aware of what you're driving at, Admiral. And I confess I'm at a loss as to the instrument's remarkable condition, too. I've worked on any number of musical instruments which have been immersed in salt water for only 3 to 5 years that were in far worse shape than this one. I'm not an oceanographer, so the solution to the puzzle eludes me. However, I can tell you to the day how long that cornet has been beneath the sea and how it came to be there.
Vogel reached over and picked up the horn. Then he slipped on a pair of rimless glasses and began reading aloud.
Presented to Graham Farley, in sincere appreciation for distinguished performance in the entertainment of our passengers by the grateful management of the White Star Line.
Vogel removed his glasses and smiled benignly at Sandecker.
When I discovered the words White Star Line, I got a friend out of bed early this morning to do a bit of research at the Naval Archives. He called only a half hour before I left for your office.
Vogel paused to remove a handkerchief from his pocket and blew his nose.
It seems Graham Farley was a very popular fellow throughout the White Star Line. He was solo cornetist for 3 years on one of their vessels. I believe it was called the Oceanic. When the company's newest luxury liner was about to set sail on her maiden voyage, the management selected the outstanding musicians from their other passenger ships and formed what was considered at the time the finest orchestra on the seas. Graham, of course, was one of the first musicians chosen.
Yes, gentlemen, this cornet has rested under the Atlantic Ocean for a very long time, because Graham Farley was playing it on the morning of April 15, 1912, when the waves closed over him and the Titanic.
The reactions to Vogel's sudden revelation were mixed. Sandecker's face turned half somber, half speculative. Guns went rigid, while Pitt's expression was one of casual interest. The silence in the room became intense as Vogel stuffed his glasses back in a breast pocket.
Titanic.
Sandecker repeated the word slowly, like a man savoring a beautiful woman's name. He gazed penetratingly at Vogel, wonder mixed with doubt still mirrored in his eyes.
It's incredible.
A fact, nonetheless, Vogel said casually. I take it, Commander Gunn, that the cornet was discovered by the Sappho-1.
Yes, near the end of the voyage.
It would appear that your undersea expedition stumbled on a bonus. A pity you didn't run onto the ship herself.
Yes, a pity, Gunn said, avoiding Vogel's eyes.
I'm still at a loss as to the instrument's condition, Sandecker said. I hardly expected a relic sunk in the sea for 75 years to come up looking little the worse for wear.
The lack of corrosion does pose an interesting question, Vogel replied.
The brass most certainly would weather well. But strangely, the parts containing ferrous metals survived in a remarkable virgin state. The original mouthpiece, as you can see, is near perfect.
Gunn was staring at the cornet as if it was the Holy Grail.
Will it still play?
Yes, Vogel answered. Quite beautifully, I should think.
You haven't tried it?
No, I have not. Vogel ran his fingers reverently over the cornet's valves. Up to now, I have always tested every brass instrument my assistants and I have restored for its brilliance of tone. This time, I cannot.
I don't understand, Sandecker said.
This instrument is a reminder of a small but courageous act performed during the worst sea tragedy in man's history, Vogel replied. It takes very little imagination to envision Graham Farley and his fellow musicians, while they soothed the frightened ship's passengers with music, sacrificing all thought of their own safety as the Titanic settled into the cold sea. The cornet's last melody came from the lips of a very brave man. I feel it would border on the sacrilegious for anyone else ever to play it again. Sandecker stared at Vogel, examining every feature of the old man's face as if he were seeing it for the first time. Autumn, Vogel was murmuring, almost rambling to himself. Autumn, an old hymn. That was the last melody Graham Farley played on his coronet. Not nearer, my God, to thee? Gunn spoke slowly. A myth, said Pitt. Autumn was the final tune that was heard from the Titanic's band just before the end. You seem to have made a study of the Titanic, Vogel said. The ship and her tragic fate is like a contagious disease, Pitt replied. Once you become interested, the fever is tough to break. The ship itself holds little attraction for me, but as a historian of musicians and their instruments, the saga of the Titanic's band has always gripped my imagination. Vogel set the cornet in the case, closed the lid, and passed it across the desk to Sandecker. Unless you have more questions, Admiral, I'd like to grab a fattening breakfast and fall into bed. It was a difficult night. Sandecker stood. We're in your debt, Mr. Vogel. I was hoping you might say that. Santa Claus' eyes twinkled slyly. There is a way you can repay me. Which is? Donate the cornet to the Washington Museum. It would be the prize exhibit of our Hall of Music. As soon as our lab people have studied the instrument and your report, I'll send it over to you. On behalf of the museum's directors, I thank you. Not as a gift donation, however. Vogel stared uncertainly at the Admiral. I don't follow. Sandecker smiled. Let's call it a permanent loan. That will save hassle in case we ever have to borrow it back temporarily. Agreed. One more thing, Sandecker said. Nothing has been mentioned to the press about the discovery. I'd appreciate it if you went along with us for the time being. I don't understand your motives, but of course I'll comply. The towering curator bid his farewells and departed. Damn, Gunn blurted out a second after the door closed. We must have passed within spitting distance of the Titanic's hulk. You were certainly in the ballpark, Pitt agreed. The Cepho's sonar probed a radius of 200 yards. The Titanic must have rested just outside the fringe of your range. If only we'd had more time. If only we'd known what in hell we were looking for. You forget, Sandecker said, that testing the Sappho-1 and conducting experiments on the Lorelei current were your primary objectives. And on that, you and your crew did one hell of a job. Oceanographers will be sifting the data you brought back on deep water currents for the next 2 years. My only regret is that we couldn't let you in on what we were up to. But Gene Seagram and his security people insist that we keep a tight lid on any information regarding the Titanic until we're far along on the salvage operation. We won't be able to keep it quiet for long, Pitt said. All the news media in the world will soon smell a story on the greatest historical find since the opening of King Tut's tomb. Sandecker rose from behind his desk and walked over to the window. When he spoke, his words came very softly, sounding almost as if they were carried over a great distance by the wind. Graham Farley's cornet. Sir? Graham Farley's cornet, Sandecker repeated wistfully. If that old horn is any indication, the Titanic may be sitting down there in the black abyss, as pretty and preserved as the night she sank.